Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
We are here at the end of June, which somehow now means it is list-making season. We're going to talk about the best TV and movies of the year so far, because there really is a lot to discuss out there. And Richard has helpfully made two lists that will be published on VF.com to help you sort through it. And now we're going to talk about both of them in depth. Okay, so let's start by talking about television. Richard, you and our colleague Sonia Soraya collaborated on a list of the best TV shows of the year so far. I love that we're just in this period of solidly like, nope, 6 months is plenty. We need lists in the halfway through the year and lists at the end. But tell me about how you kind of pieced together what your favorite shows of the year so far were.
Well, I just want to say, you know, not only, Katie, will we get year-end lists, we're going to get decade-end lists, too.
So, oh, Jesus Christ.
It's going to be listomania in December.
Like, we're just going to start arguing about The Social Network all over again, just when it felt like we were finished.
Exactly. But yeah, the TV list, I mean, it's mostly Sonia who came up with it, and I sort of added some things there at the end. But it's such a hard thing to do now because, you know, we say it probably every week or when we talk, or at least when we talk about TV on this podcast, like there's just so much. And, you know, one omission from our best of the year so far list is Russian Doll, which people were on Twitter were like, where is that show? And it's like, you know, not everything can get in, partly because there are some other like weirder, smaller things like Pen 15 or I Think You Should Leave that like it felt really important that we include on the list.
Because making a top 10 isn't just about what you really like. It's about signal boosting. Like you take that into account for this or film list or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it's all, you know, it's all subjective. So like, you know, sometimes people get very indignantly angry and it's like, well, I mean, it's not like, we're not breaking a law. Like, like we can, these things can be whatever they are, you know, they we want them to be. But yeah, you absolutely, I think, do want to give a show that maybe hasn't gotten the same amount of attention as another show, that little bit of a boost because, again, there's so much out there. And I think that like, part of our job as critics now is less about gatekeeping and more about like advocacy and saying like, here's this thing that you need to see because, you know, I guess we're kind of curating it for people because there's just, you know, that you can't focus on all of it at once. It would go crazy.
So what's the thing that you felt the most strongly about getting out there to curate for people and tell them to watch?
Well, I'm not proud of this, but Love Island. which is a British dating show that's been on. Its fifth season is currently airing, and I guess that's what we're technically counting as the best TV this year. But yeah, I got into the show last year with season four. It is I guess it's 5 days a week, maybe six days a week with a recap episode of just British singles, Irish people, Scotsmen, Scotswomen, in a house in Mallorca, but like not anywhere near the coast. Like, just like there's like just surrounded by farmland, and they just like hang out in the sun all day, and they get coupled up with each other, and there's like minor drama, but it's really just like about these. I think I described them as house cats, just kind of chasing patches of sun around this like deck. and it's like so mind-blankingly, like nothing happens. And yet I'm riveted every episode. And so while there are problems with the show in terms of who they have on the show and how they, you know, how they cast it, it's not a totally positively like representative or politically forward show for this era, but it's still just if you want to turn your brain off for a summer, there you could do a little better, I think, than Love Island.
I don't think you're a viewer of The Bachelor, but does it feel like kind of a corrective to that the whole toxic idea that came up from that of like people getting too drunk and consent issues and like there's always a racist on The Bachelor? Like, is it just like, okay, just people like liking each other on television?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. Like, you do see people on Love Island drink. But my understanding is in earlier seasons, my boyfriend has actually gone back and is now watching season one, and I've like seen like an episode or two of it, and I'm like, oh, it's...
You have too much power, Richard.
I'm ruining someone else's life. but it's different because like, well, you see them getting actually kind of drunk, but also apparently there was a rule starting with season four where like it's put out by ITV2 in the UK. Maybe it was like some British governmental thing where like you cannot show people smoking as much as they are smoking. So they had like a little cigarette area that I guess they had cameras on. Now they took the cameras away. So you never see anyone smoking cigarettes. You never see anyone drunk. There's implications of sex, but it's so chaste and like everyone is kind of nice to each other and supportive of each other. It's not like an American show where within, you know, like the Real World Road Rules Challenge where within, you know, 2 minutes people are having like rum soaked. Fist fights. Like that is not happening on this show. And or if it is, it's happening off camera, which I find really refreshing. It's really pretty pleasant. Sometimes there's like, you know, an argument or things get a little bit dramatic. But for the most part, yeah, it's just so like even keeled and crucially different from an American reality show. And yeah, part of the reason why I don't watch The Bachelor or whatever else.
I'm not going to say I was surprised not to see Game of Thrones on your list because, you know, we've all discussed that show and how it ended ad nauseum. Are people mad at you for leaving that off too?
That I actually haven't heard about, which is interesting. You know, I just wrote a piece for one of our special issues, the Emmy issue that'll be out this summer for voters about like what shows will kind of take the mantle from Game of Thrones and Veep, which the conventional wisdom is that those are going to kind of, you know, run the table at the Emmys in the comedy and drama categories. And as I was writing it, I was like, maybe Game of Thrones won't because, you know, excuse me, a lot of people were like not into that season. So including me and Sonia. I mean, I liked aspects of it, but, you know, so I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how that show's legacy kind of endures past this, you know, this immediate moment, because I think that like it's just not really hanging in our memory the way that it would seem to have before the season started.
I've started to wonder that as well. And then also thinking about living in a post-Green Book world, how much we're taking our Twitter feeds as evidence of how larger voting bodies think you can go back and forth forever.
Right.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. And also like part of the work of like we do in this podcast and certainly we do on VF.com and our special issues about the Emmys is like trying to figure out like where the Television Academy's brain is going to be. And looking at our list, you know, we have Rami, the Hulu show. We have When They See Us, Ava DuVernay's show about the Central Park Five. You know, these are shows that like maybe could get Emmy attention. Fosse Verdon certainly feels like likely to. But there's a world in which, you know, on this list of 10, maybe just Barry and Chernobyl are the only things that actually get a lot of, you know, Emmy. Oh, well, Veep, yes, of course, yes. Veep is on there too, yes. But in terms of, like, newer stuff, it's increasingly feeling like, you know, sort of viewers, like critics or sort of diehard TV fans and Emmy voters are really on, you know, diverging paths. Maybe there will be some convergence coming in the future when once Game of Thrones and Veep have rolled through and the Academy has to find new things to give prizes to, but... it'll be interesting to see how much, you know, our list of the best shows so far when the Emmys nominations come out next month, if they sync up at all.
Joanna, would Game of Thrones be on your list of the year so far? Is that too loaded a question?
I don't think so. Like, best of 2019? No, I don't think it would. Like, there are other sort of... accolades we can hand it, like most momentous, or you know what I mean? Like the thing we were all watching, like that's certainly true. But when you look at the
most show,
the most show. But when you look at the list that Sonia and Richard put together, I mean, there's so much good stuff that I've been catching up on since Game of Thrones. Like, I think you should leave. I love that you put that on there, Richard. This is the Tim Robinson Netflix sort of sketch series that friend of the show, Matt Patches, was sort of banging on about a while ago, but finally some friends sat me down and we watched, like, couldn't stop watching it. It was so good. So I'm a big fan of that. And those are, I mean, I know I've talked about the Television Critics Awards on this podcast, but, like, this list that you guys put together, these are the shows that I'm seeing reflected in the nominations for the Television Critics Awards. And it's not like the TCAs have ever, like, very closely aligned with the Emmys, but this is exactly the other advocacy. I mean, why else do we do this if not to shine a light on something that doesn't have a multi-million, you know, Game of Thrones doesn't need our boost, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, like, these other, you know, I don't know if you've heard of Netflix, but Netflix sometimes needs some help with its shows. No, I'm just kidding. this is a really good list that you guys put together. I have no arguments, no complaints, except maybe Russian Doll, but you heard enough of that. So, and I'm really glad the other two is on here too. There's, like, a lot of nice comedies on here, which is a nice break from, you know, we cover a lot of prestige drama when Richard and I do still watching, but it's nice to remember all the good comedies that are out there.
Yeah, and I think increasingly for me, I'm suffering from a little TV fatigue this year. I'm not quite sure. I think it's because I've just become hideously addicted to YouTube and just spending all my time watching that. But, like, I love a comedy now because it's short, it's easily kind of digestible, and there's so much good stuff being put out there. You know, and if people are listening, like, I Think You Should Leave is, it doesn't immediately seem like everyone's cup of tea. It's, you know, a lot of scatological humor.
Right.
It's really, you know, it's a little juvenile, if you want to call it that. But, like, if you just give in to, like, the first episode, like, I have friends who I would otherwise think are sort of a little bit snooty about the kind of stuff they watch.
I'm snooty.
Who are just all in on it. Yeah. And they're just, everyone's just, like, all in on it. Cause it's just like, I just feel like I'm, like, 14 years old and laughing at, like, you know, Liar Liar or whatever dumb comedy I liked back then, you know? It just feels good. It's like a very kind of cathartic feeling.
Yeah, completely. And it's one of those things where, like, they sat me down. They already liked it so much. They sat me down to watch it. And I think maybe if I had been watching it on my own, I would have stopped watching. But I was, like, watching with people who really wanted me to like it. So I was like, okay, I'll just, like, sort of make it through these sketches. And then all of a sudden I was just, like, dying and loving it. So, yeah. And it sticks. It sticks better than, any SNL sketch that I've seen this year. So, you know.
Well, and speaking of SNL, because Tim Robinson was a writer there for a while and was a performer for a year, it makes wonderful use of Vanessa Bayer and Cecily Strong. Vanessa Bayer, who's not on the show anymore, Cecily Strong, who is, two of the best performers to come out of that show in the last decade, I think. And, you know, Bayer got plenty of airtime and Strong still does, but, like, I still feel like they're underused, or we haven't seen enough of them outside of the, you know, the world of SNL.
Yeah.
So it's really fun that they each get a sketch where they feature prominently, and one of them in particular, Vanessa Bayer's, went really viral because it was the first
it's so good.
You know, sketch that Netflix released, and it's brilliant.
That show was, like, not totally my thing, I think, because, like, sometimes absurdist comedy just goes past me, but that Vanessa Bayer sketch, and also because it's, you know, it's about, like, people at brunch, like, posting pictures of each other to Instagram, it has this, like, cultural commentary that a lot of the rest of the show doesn't, at least from what I saw. And also, like you said, Richard, Vanessa Bayer is such a treasure.
And it's not sneering. It's not,
it's making
fun of something without kind of condemning the people, which I think is a really crucial distinction.
Yeah, and it's kind of relatable in the way that you feel like you watch everyone else use social media. You're like, am I doing this wrong? Like, I feel like everyone's having more fun on this than me.
The sketch that I've seen sort of memed the most, and it is also my favorite, is this, like, car pitching session sketch. And there's just, like, this one great guy who apparently is, like, a known figure, I don't know, elsewhere in the world, but I've never seen him before, who just, like, goes off in this car pitching. So you might have seen this, like, older gentleman with white hair saying stuff like, you have no good car ideas. That's from that sketch. It's so good. So, and I think that's, like, episode 3 or 4, something like that. And then I'm really glad that you have the other two on here as well. Speaking of SNL alums, the other two is TBS comedy from Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, who were head writers on what I think was the most successful SNL season in, like, recent memory. Like, the show was sort of creating for me, and then they took over as, like, co-head writers. It was, you know, it was like the election boost year sort of thing. But they just did all this great work. They did a lot of, like, They did a lot of great work with the women of the SNL cast. It was just like a really good time for SNL. And then they abruptly left to do this show. And you're like, oh, no, but what? Oh, come back. But the other two is so good that I can't really blame them for doing it. So I'm glad to see it on here.
Yeah, it's a show that surprised me because I, on paper, was like, I'm not sure if I'm going to like that. Like, it just felt a little too hip or on the nose or whatever. I was so pleasantly surprised that when watching the other two, that it's not a mean show. Again, talking about the Love Island thing, like it has genuine affection for its characters. It's about the siblings of a kid who becomes a sort of overnight Justin Bieber-esque sensation. And you think, okay, so the kid is going to be this total monster. Nope. When you think it's going to go one way, it goes the other, while still being a sort of biting satire of, certain kind of celebrity culture right now and a culture of vanity that social media kind of has engendered.
Yeah, it's a little Schitt's Creek-y that way, like in that it's biting but nice. You know what I mean? And these people are ridiculous but like ultimately pretty nice. And so you're like enjoying watching it. Unlike, you know, stuff that I can't watch, like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is too mean and my heart can't stand it. But the other two has these like nice moments where you're just sort of like, oh, okay, I like it. Yeah.
Just to kind of state the obvious, I don't think we've talked, I think everyone has talked enough about Fleabag. And if you haven't watched Fleabag, watch Fleabag. I was happy to see it on your list. Whenever I start thinking about like what I've seen this year, and granted, I haven't seen that many movies, like Fleabag just feels like obviously the best thing that I've seen this year anywhere. So the more that we talk about that, the more I start letting myself think it might get somewhere in the Emmys, which might be false, but at least it can be on lists like this.
No, I mean, like Amazon comedies tend to do like fairly well at the Emmys. And I think, I don't know if that's because they know how to play the awards game better than other people or whatever. Like Catastrophe got nominated at least. Like I can see Phoebe getting like some nominations for writing or something like that, at least. Something like that, you know?
Yeah, and it definitely feels like, Katie, kind of what you were saying, that like, granted, you know, I'm speaking from something of a bubble, but like Fleabag has been the thing this season,
yeah.
You know, this half of the year. Like it's the thing that's most universally spoken about in positive, really like effusive tones at a time when its creator, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, is like, her star is ascendant for not only this show, but other stuff that she's worked on. It feels like really tapped into the zeitgeist right now. And, you know, that's probably not true for everyone across the country, but I could see that making an impression on voters where they would almost feel like, well, if we don't put that show in the mix, then like we're going to seem so out of touch.
Yeah.
She got an Emmy nomination for the first season of Killing Eve. So I could definitely see her getting at least in the writing category. I could definitely see her getting at least a writing nomination. Of course, I would love a nomination for Andrew Scott. And I don't know that the comedy category is as closed down as the drama category. You know, I think there's definitely room for this. And like Fleabag and Barry are those comedies that seem like they're cheating when they're in the comedy category, right? Because they're basically dramas. But often those do better when it comes to nomination times because you're like, oh, they're doing so much more emotional work. And like hardcore comedians are over here taking pratfalls and they're like, this is work. Come on. Leave my category alone. So,
well, that's
know.
What's funny about Succession, which is going to be competing in the drama category, which I'm catching up on, is from last summer. So it's technically too old, but it's like one of the funniest things that I'm watching right now. And it's a drama, but like it, because it has such carefully constructed jokes. So those lines kind of matter only for awards categories, and then they just get so blurry.
Yeah. Katie, I think you're the only one among the three of us, I think, who's seen Fosse Verdon, because it's still on my list of to catch up when I was in my Game of Thrones K-hole. What do you think of that being on the list here, and what do you think of it in terms of like Emmy thoughts and feelings?
I did not manage to finish Fosse Verdon because also got stuck in the Game of Thrones. I know. I feel so embarrassed because I was so excited about it and like still am excited about it. I'm like looking forward to it. It feels like one of those like meals you need to prepare to sit down for,
yeah.
Which might be why we're still trying to catch up. But yeah, I mean, from what I watched, like Michelle Williams is giving like the performance of a lifetime, which she routinely does. I think she is so well suited to screen work. Like her face is so expressive. And I thought about this when I saw her in Cabaret on Broadway a couple years ago, which is kind of a funny practice for this. where it felt like she kind of got lost by the size of the stage. And like just having something that's like crafted in this way and on TV week after week, like we've talked about for Still Watching, how like so many great shows get dumped all at once and you have to spend forever catching up. It's like HBO and FX who are doing the like week by week exploration. And even though I'm going to catch up on the rest of Fosse Verdon is kind of like a binge, kind of like watching it play out and watching people discuss elements of Bob Fosse's life and Gwen Verdon's life week by week, I really appreciated its place in the TV conversation.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting show. I watched, I guess, the first five because I wrote a review of it. And it's like the big question I had was, who is this for? I mean, I know it was for me and for you, Katie, like for like theater nerds, like, yes, for sure. But like in a broader sense, you have these two big stars, Academy Award nominee, Academy Award winner. You're putting some money into this, and yet it still felt admirably niche, like it was very specific about its world. And so I'm eager to finish the series too, because I want to see where they take it. And I think that it's the kind of thing that, because it has the star power, will sort of resonate. And it's comfortably a limited series or a miniseries. It is not, they're not doing more of it, you know?
It's not going to Big Little Lies season two here.
Right. So I really think that it has a clear category that voters can put it in. And I think that will help it considerably, especially this year when you have the Television Academy being like, okay, sorry, you know, no more of this. American Horror Story, you're a drama series. Big Little Lies, you're a drama series. Like none of this limited series, like fudging the rules. So I think they're getting a little bit more strict about that, which I think is fair. Fosse Verdon, which is distinctly this, you know, closed circuit of a thing, will do well. Then again, it has Chernobyl to contend with, which was this kind of
really
under the radar thing that then just broke out big. We talked about it last week, but I feel like those are two pretty big juggernauts that are going to be going head to head.
If Chernobyl wins limited series, it's HBO, HBO, HBO with Game of Thrones, Veep, and Chernobyl. That's it's really something.
and somehow still Sharp Objects is eligible, right?
Yeah, they aired last summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just can't believe that Amy Adams is going to have done like all of that and not get anything. It makes me crazy because she's so good. That was the TV performance for me. So the other show that I thought I would mention that's not on your list, but I would add it if I were to, which is Better Things, Pamela Adlon's FX series. This is a show that could have gotten like sort of sunk down entirely in the Louis C.K. controversy, because Pamela Adlon sort of like, she was the creator, but he was sort of, you know, she was on Louis with him. He was, you know, a co-exec producer on it. He wrote a bunch for it. And so when sort of he became persona non grata in the industry and at FX specifically, like the number one question I heard from people is, what's going to happen to Better Things? And the answer is Better Things is as good as, if not better than ever before. And Pamela Adlon sort of running the whole thing herself is just incredible. And so it's a show that I really, really love that I think flies under the radar. Like critics don't forget about it, but I feel like and honestly, awards winners don't really forget about it. Pamela Adlon's been nominated a bunch of times, but you know, I don't hear people talk about it as much as I would like them to. So there's something about the FX comedies, because You're the Worst is another one that I just like. FX has had its issues getting its comedies that aren't like Louis, and I guess It's Always Sunny, the longest running comedy on TV ever, to like really stick in the conversation the way that some of the other platforms do. So,
hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, so let's move on to talking about movies. Richard, you're also going to have a list of the best movies of the year, which is, it's amazing that you managed to do both of these lists when you have spent the whole year watching Love Island. It's an impressive use of your time.
I mean, I'm just making it up.
You haven't seen any of these. Richard, maybe we should just start with what made Joanna and I both gasp when we took a look at your look at your list. Alita Battle Angel, huh?
Literal gasp mm-hmm. into the microphone. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly the reaction one wants when putting together a best of list. Because you want to throw in the little surprise. Yeah, it's a big, silly action spectacular that Robert Rodriguez directed, that James Cameron produced, that didn't do horribly at the box office, but certainly did not do the money, the kind of money that it was supposed to when it was initially conceived. You know, big sci-fi robot cyborg sort of epic that I just loved. I you know, earnestly. It feels like the kind of thing. It's based on a manga, so it is, you know, based on something. It's not a totally original idea, but it is a semi sort of superhero story that, like, wasn't about the same 10 Marvel characters that you're used to seeing. So I really appreciated that. But I know that that's polarizing.
I think my favorite role that Alita Battle Angel now has in culture is that it's responsible for Dark Phoenix getting shoved around the schedule. Like, it managed not only to, as you said, to kind of have its own superhero story, but doomed another one. It's a strange footnote in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the scuttlebutt is that James Cameron, again, who is a producer, got Fox to move Dark Phoenix because he wanted to make room for Alita. They still dumped it kind of in February in a way that felt maybe unfair to the movie. You know, and it's the kind of thing where at the end they really set up a sequel with a kind of surprise celebrity cameo who is going to be the villain in the next movie, and I don't think we're going to get that. So I would just, you know, caveat that to people who haven't seen the movie yet and are encouraged by my raving about it to go see it, that, like, there might be a slight sense of, you know, unmet needs or, you know, an unsatisfied quality to the end of the movie. But I still think it's really fun and feels like, you know, it's weird. It's a big corporate enterprise, yes, but, like, it still has a sort of individual flair to it that I really appreciate.
I understand that, just not talking about Battle Angel forever, but one of the things that intrigues me most that I've heard that does make me want to see it is that Christoph Waltz is not giving the same performance he feels like he's been giving ever since Inglourious Basterds.
You think for like 2 seconds that he's like some sort of villain, but then he's just like nice dad. He's a nice dad. He's a nice mad scientist dad.
With a big, crazy hammer weapon.
Between him and Ben Mendelsohn and Captain Marvel, it feels like a good year for villainous character actors playing nice dads in a surprising twist. Yeah.
There's like, what, 4 Oscar winners in Alita Battle Angel, right? It's Jennifer Connelly, Mahershala Ali, Christoph Waltz. That's crazy. I really hated that movie, like with like so much every fiber of my being. And I think it was exasperating for me. And I remember Richard and I were like texting about it afterwards, and like Richard's like, I really loved it, but like, is this problematic adaptation from the manga? And I was like, no, it's fine. And he's like, great, I can just love it. And I'm like, no, it's bad. Anyway, I had this like weird Q&A that came with my screening, which had James Cameron and his producers and Robert Rodriguez and some of the actors answering questions. And they were just like patting themselves on the back. These, like, Jennifer Connelly was basically silent. So was Rosa Salazar, who plays the titular Battle Angel. And these men were just patting themselves on the back for creating what they called basically an elegant allegory for female puberty. And I was just like, give me a break. I can't.
Oh, well, that's like, I don't want to hear that.
I was just like, what? I mean, I think, like, I was already like hard mixed on that just because I don't like a lot of CG. Like, that's just not my thing. But like, I was already hard mixed on the movie that I saw that. And I was like, I think groaned aloud in the theater, and maybe like they wanted to kick me out. But I was just like, are you kidding me? The audience I saw it with loved it though, and it might be like a fun home watch, but I don't know, man. What else is on your list, Richard?
Well, a movie that I was really happy to include because I think it really came and went with a disproportionate sort of amount of buzz was Her Smell.
Oh my god, yes.
And that's a movie by Alex Ross Perry that we've talked about on this podcast already, so I won't belabor it too much.
But he was like a guest on the show. Anyone should go back and listen to it.
Yeah, he's a great, really just loves films, knows, you know, a lot about it, and is curious to learn more, and which is a great kind of energy for a younger director to have. And Elizabeth Moss' performance that is, I think, unparalleled. I think it's the best work that she's done. It's really exciting. It's in a different vein than we've seen her before. It's just a really exciting, hard to watch, exhausting, but in a good way, kind of trip through the ringer. I think it'll have a life, you know, on VOD or on airplanes maybe, or, you know, on cable. I don't know. But I think that that movie's narrative isn't quite done. But I was a little bit disappointed that it didn't really make any sort of rumble at the independent art house box office when it came out this spring.
Yeah, I watched this movie at home, which is a privilege that a lot of people don't have. And I think it is maybe easier to watch in your own house because it is deliberately kind of challenging you to spend time with this character who is punishing and who is like isolating and driving crazy all the people in her life, which is very much the point. It really pays that off later on. But like you said, Richard, like Elizabeth Moss is just doing this next level performance that I really feel like everyone ought to see. And I, at least, I'm going to consider it my mission to just keep talking about her when award season comes around. I don't know what good it will do, but it will drive me crazy if she gets totally overlooked because she is so incredible in that movie.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that movie lingers. I mean, I think, you know, the conventional wisdom for so long was always, oh, if you put the movie out in the spring, it's not an Oscar movie. And that's changed, obviously. I mean, we just had, you know, recent examples in Black Panther and Get Out, which were both February releases that did, you know, very well in terms of Oscar nominations. So I don't know if I should be like, oh, well, because that movie came out in April, it's just dead in the water. But I'm a little concerned for it. I wish that it could get like a little, boutique re-release or something in November just to kind of make it fresh in people's minds. The other game you could play, which is one that the wife did to, well, not the ultimate success, but almost success.
A lot of success.
Was you just be the first screener. The first screener that arrives on voters' desks or in their mailboxes. I don't know what time of year, like in October, whenever, you know. I hope that there's some sort of campaign behind it because, you know, Elizabeth Moss has done well at the Emmys. Like, she's a very respected actress who has not lacked, you know, for awards attention. But this does feel like a real kind of confirmation of something a little bit bigger that I hope that her due comes, although it's going to be a really crowded year, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting because to speak of Elizabeth Moss and films that were perhaps released too early in like awards consideration, the conversation around Us, I feel like, has really died off. Elizabeth Moss is incredible in Us, by the way, as are, of course, Lupita Nyong'o and other people. But that was a film that when it came out, a lot of people were like, oh, this is gonna be even like legsier than Get Out. And I was like, I don't think so. Like, it's so much more challenging than Get Out. And like, I like that Jordan Peele made it, but I still think it was kind of a mistake to release that one as early as they did. So
interesting. You think it would have played in like in the fall and had more of an awards boost?
I think I think if we were talking about Lupita then, it would be a different conversation than talking about her at the beginning of the year and being like, maybe Lupita, and then all these other people sort of crowd in and make you forget about it. So, you know, I think it got like a larger opening box office, but it just doesn't have that like conversational lingering element you want.
Well, it's also like Get Out was like probably like literally a perfect movie. Like, it's one of those screenplays you see where you're like, this is a polished jewel that doesn't kind of step wrong. And Us, like you're saying, it's like more challenging. It's got more going on. So it kind of has less, it's not like it's hard to embrace, but it kind of has less of a kind of an impeccable narrative around it, which is fine.
And I also just don't think it's as like populist.
Yeah.
So you don't have people memeing it or like going repeat viewing it and stuff like that. But I do love that is the movie that Jordan Peele decided to make with his cachet. And I hope he keeps pushing that. So what else you got, Richard?
Well, another movie, The Souvenir by Joanna Hogg, that I questioned its release strategy, but, you know, far be it for me to question the gods at A24. But that's a lovely memory piece. Another memory piece that's called Sorry Angel, which is a French film that I first saw at Cannes last year that is set, you know, midpoint through the AIDS crisis in the early 1990s. That's just beautiful and sad and really grips you in a way that feels like kind of reading a really dense, interesting novel. And then there's this other film that
Toy Story.
I thought it was just called Forky. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Ballad of Forky,
which, as we know now, was a total box office failure. It only made $125 million in its opening weekend.
How dare!
Which has everyone, you know, ringing the bells of doom. But yeah, it feels a little corny to put a movie like that on a list like this, you know, because you want to be a little bit like cooler and edgier and not sort of be drinking the Pixar Kool-Aid. But I think it's a lovely movie, and if you're gonna make a fourth movie after a trilogy has released, really seemingly ended. There's a good way to do it, which we talked about last week on this podcast. So yeah, I felt like it only felt necessary to include that, even though it doesn't really need the help. Although, or maybe it does. No. I don't know.
I've seen Toy Story 4 since we talked about it last week. And what really struck me is not just like kind of the emotional stuff you talked about, Richard, where I think some people have said it's for baby boomers, like getting used to being empty nesters. And you pointed out that it's for people who maybe don't have children and need to, like, maybe secretly need to be told that, like, that's okay too. But it's also really funny. Like, I just enjoyed seeing it and all the new characters they added, like St. Keanu Reeves showing up as this evil Knievel type. So it's not just that they, like, really nailed the themes again, but they justified its existence by reminding you how enjoyable this world is in the first place.
And how clever they are, you know? And there's, like, a little bit of a, like, I don't know, a slight undernote of smugness there, but I don't really care because, like, they're just, like, every time, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but there are sort of, they're villains to an extent that are basically ventriloquist dummies, and they're so creepy, and the movie knows it, and it cuts to their horrifying faces at certain points in just this really, like, on, like, just, it's just kind of pitch perfect the way that they use that, and they, because they know it's funny, but they don't kind of belabor the joke. It's just, I don't know, they're very smart at how they do those movies, and I have to kind of tip my hat to that, even if I'm not fully on board with the broader sort of Pixar world.
I don't know if you know this, Katie, but Forky is getting his own Disney Plus TV show.
I learned this recently. I'm very excited. It will be on rotation in my house, I'm sure.
I wanted to ask you, Richard, maybe it's the same question as we asked about the TV list, which is like when you look at your list and we'll have other entries from either Kurt or Cam Collins, like when you look at that list and you compare it to the top like box office winners, there's only like one overlap, which is Toy Story, Forky. So like what is the disconnect between the movies that people are going to see and the movies that we think are the best? You guys have a lot of like good foreign and like niche under the radar stuff on there. Is this a question of advocacy, or is this just like a widening gap between the popcorn fare that people are actually getting out of their house to see and the actual good stuff, which is so micro that people aren't watching it in theaters?
Well, I mean, I think that it's partly because we're doing this halfway through the year. You know, I think by the end of the year, we will have had, one hopes, some not franchisee, you know, movie that's done well at the box office, you know, because there's usually one or two every year that, you know,
like A Star Is Born or something.
Sure. Exactly. But, you know, studios and other distributors are gradually realigning their thinking about, like, what time of year movie should come out in, which is why you now have big tentpole movies that come out in February, where previously that would never have happened, and why you have little indies come out that should, you know, sort of traditionally be fall movies. But, you know, this has been a really trying year. I think people talk about Men in Black International doing so poorly, or Godzilla, or Dark Phoenix. And yeah, those are kind of obvious examples of a certain malaise that has affected movies in North America this year. But if you go further down the line, I mean, I mean, poor me, like, pull out your tiny violin. But, like, it's been hard to be a film critic this year because I'm just, like, there's not a ton that I can get excited about. I feel really strongly about all the movies on this list. But I think it does represent a sort of, I don't want to say lackluster, but a quieter year, let's say, than in years past. Maybe Alita Battle Angel wouldn't be on my list if there had been something else, but I just didn't see that something else. You know, I liked Captain Marvel, and I liked, I didn't mind Men in Black International, but like, Alita is the only movie of its scope and scale that really said anything to me this year, which, you know, I think in years past that's not really been true. So we're in a bit of a fallow period. I mean, obviously television is, you know, roaring away, but I have hopes that this list will look different in December and I'll have a lot more to add to it.
I mean, justice for Detective Pikachu and all that. No, I'm just kidding.
But Jenna, I do feel like there are maybe a couple more populist things that might make your list if you're making one. Like, are you still a Captain Marvel diehard at this point in the year?
I don't know that I was ever a Captain Marvel diehard, and I don't know that Captain Marvel would make my top 10 list, though I really did like it. I might put Avengers Endgame on there, but maybe not. I don't know. I would definitely consider putting it on there, if only for like the same reason, the most movie. Just like Game of Thrones is the most TV. But I did write down a couple other movies. Booksmart, I would definitely put in my top 10. It's controversial to say, but like that, I guess, which is a weird thing that happened to Booksmart. But that was a movie that really spoke to me when I saw it at South By and like has only grown in my estimation since. So I'm hoping that like outside the cloud of controversy, people will discover Booksmart at home. That would make me really happy.
Well, I feel like also, since we talked about it, performance at the box office. I'm just looking at Box Office Mojo. It's made $20 million, which is not less than it deserves, I think, but not doing so bad for itself. So that was a nice, like, delayed happy ending that I found.
Yeah, and then in the top 20, you will find another thing that, like, I just can't stop thinking about it, even though I know it's not a great movie, which is Rocket Man. Like, there's so much good in Rocket Man that, like, is kneecapped by some stuff that it doesn't need. But over time and distance, I just think about the good stuff. And I'm like, oh, Rocket Man was so good in part. So like, I don't know that I could in good conscience put it on like a top 10. But it's definitely one that I've been thinking a lot about. And I'll be curious to see how that does. I mean, it did fine at the box office. No Bohemian Rhapsody, but it did fine. But I'll be really curious to see if maybe Rocket Man hitting home release will give Taron some kind of surge in award season later this year. I don't know. Like it might be to its benefit to have been released now so that people can watch it at home later, possibly.
Yeah, I would like to see him stick around. I still haven't seen Rocket Man, even though I've had like Fosse Verdon and been excited for it. I gotta like just treat myself to things that I want to see. But it is funny at this point in the year when we start talking about awards, because we can't help ourselves, that the shape still feels so fuzzy. Like there's a handful of things that we expect to see in the fall, we've seen trailers for, but a lot still won't be known until like Toronto and Venice start announcing their lineups in August. So it is a funny period to be like, yeah, Taron, why not? And you truly, why not? Like all the other potential stuff that could come in could flop terribly and he'll still be standing like Elton John and the song.
Yes. Hopefully Taron will still be standing at the end of the year.
Can't help myself. Yeah. Any last ones, Joanna?
That I would put in my top 10? I don't think so. I think I, too, am excited to see what happens in the rest of the year. We shall see. But I'm really excited to check out some of these things on Richard and Cam's list that I haven't had a chance to watch yet. Her Smell, I think, is streaming already, isn't it? Like, I can catch that at home.
That seems likely.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually shooting to the top of my list.
Yeah, I have a
Your
list of
influence, Richard.
I have a list of what's streaming now that I need to catch up on, which includes Apollo 11, the documentary that like blew everybody's minds. High Life is on iTunes now, Under the Silver Lake, which is very controversial, but I still would like to catch up on. And I believe Gloria Bell should either be streaming now or out soon. And I feel like I owe that to myself. So even those of us who don't get out of the house have a lot to catch up on.
Gloria Bell didn't make our list, but it was close. And I think that's a really nice little movie. Although I would also urge people to go seek out the same director's original Chilean film, just called Gloria, which is, I think, a little bit better. But Gloria Bell is, if you don't want to have to read subtitles, or if maybe you speak Spanish, then you're fine.
Or you need Julianne Moore to hold your hand.
She's got like a fun pair of glasses in it, and she like does crazy things. You know, it's fun.
I'm just not sure why we would be discussing awards at all at this point when we haven't seen my film, Cats, which comes out later this year. So.
Did you write and direct it? Is that what you mean?
I did. I've been inspired by Richard's work on the Trolls franchise, and I was like, I'd like to try my hand at a musical. So I conceived of this idea of what if Cats, but singing, you know? So I'm looking forward to you all seeing that creation.
Yeah, I mean, I think my best of the year list is just going to be that. It's just going to be Cats. Like, there's not going to be anything else. And then my best of the decade list is just going to be Cats.
Yeah.
I think it should just be like 1 through 10, each of the cats' names. You're like Grisabella,
Griddlebone,
Mungo Jerry, and Rumpel Teaser. So, you know.
I have so much Cats catch up to do. That does it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, since it's 4th of July week, we will be taking a bit of a break, but we'll be sharing interviews. Richard talked to Jack Rayner of Midsommar, and I talked to Lynn Shelton, the director of a new film, Sword of Trust. So we'll be back with you. Look for the episode, and then we'll be return after the holiday. In the meantime, you can find us all at vanityfair.com, where you can find the list of the best TV shows and movies of the year so far. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
And Joanna.
Skimble Shanks, the Railway Cat.
This episode was edited and produced by Kyle Oppenheimer, and this week's award for the best protest sign at the 2020 Oscars goes to Joanna Robinson.
Justice for Detective Pikachu.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.